Well, I'm glad to see everyone here today. I can assure you we have a very interesting speaker. I had the privilege of riding with her from D.C. this morning, and I'm amazed at all that she has been involved in over the years, and both in interfaith education as well as lots of mediation and peace building in a variety of settings, both international and within the gang community of Los Angeles. Dr. Najiba Syed Miller is here from, she's the director of the Center for Global Peace Building, which is part of the new, now I'm blanking on the name of it, Claremont Lincoln University. She's actually at Claremont Theological School of Theology, but she that is part of an interfaith or multi-faith consortium that is formed into this Claremont Lincoln University. She may be telling us a little more about that during her presentation. But Najiba, we're so happy you made the trip here. I've told her, coming from LA, she must have brought this cold weather we're having today. You can see she feels a little cold and is not quite used to it. But we're looking forward to hearing from you and having a chance for some conversation and after your presentation. So, welcome.
So, welcome. It's such a delight to be here. So, this week I'm here in Virginia. Next weekend I have to speak in Paris. So, I consider this the more exotic location, so it's delightful to be here. So as you heard, my background is in peacemaking and conflict resolution, and I owe a lot to both the Mennonite and Quaker communities. When I was 15, I traveled back to Kashmir for the first time since I was 3 years old. I became a naturalized U.S. citizen because of the incredible violence that that part of the world had experienced. So when I went back, I noticed that every 50 feet there was a soldier, and that this part of the world has one of the highest military to civilian ratios in the world. The border between India and Pakistan is essentially a border that's one of the most dangerous borders. And so at that age, when I was 15, I said, I'm dedicating my life to peace building. And it was my relationship with my own religious tradition. There's a tradition of the Prophet that says, Prophet Muhammad, upon him be peace, that God is not merciful to those who do not show mercy to others. So my vertical relationship with God is predicated on my horizontal relationship with other human beings and establishing peace. So they're not independent of one another, they're interdependent. And so many people ask me, so are you a peacemaker despite your tradition? And I always say, no, I'm a peacemaker because I'm a Muslim. Those are directly related. So that journey of peacemaking led me to come back. And when I was looking at colleges at the age of 17, really the people that do peacemaking in terms of their research, theology, and orientation were the Quaker and Mennonite communities. And I was benefited from reading great scholars like Yoder and others who've informed my own formation as a peacemaker. So I come to you with that as my contextual framework, someone who's deeply engaged within my own tradition and also performs forms of inquiry with other communities that have been dedicated to nonviolence and just peacemaking. So I was asked today to talk a little bit about what might, or I don't know if I proposed this topic or I was asked to speak about it. This is what happens when you have 3 hour jet lag. I couldn't get any rest. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about this notion of an Abrahamic peacemaking initiative and what might an Abrahamic perspective on peacemaking look like. So the reason I proposed this topic, Andrew was asked to speak about it, is the idea that more and more as Muslims, Jews, and Christians are in encounter and in relationship with one another, we often think about our individual traditions and our own theological orientation to peacemaking And largely the conversation is often a contested conversation. So what might it look like for us to begin to think of a framework that is deeply engaged within our own traditions and also focus on perhaps some common values that allow for an interdependent relationship at the human level to solve some of the world's greatest problems? As many of you know, Professor Hans Kung and others have talked about the key to peace in this century, the key to peace in the next millennium, is the ability to harness the capacity of religion for peacemaking. Not only is it that religion is used very often for violence, that's clearly one reason, but religion is also one of the major motivational factors in doing good in this world. We know that people who have such an orientation are the ones that perform charity. People who have a religious perspective, whatever that may be, are the ones that will speak up when the market or the economy leaves everyone behind. We know that people who choose a religious path are the ones who have a higher value to answer to and accountability. So it's not just that religion is used for violence. It's not just that religion is an antidote for violence, but religion allows us to move into a space of what I call not just peacemaking, but peace production. That there are some people who emanate from whatever tradition they are, such a presence that their very capacity illuminates with radiance, that's the word that Mevlana Rumi uses, with radiance such that those that are around them are induced to peaceful behavior. So I think it's important to think less and less about how do we go in into conflicts and think more and more how do our own traditions inform a preventive approach so that the engagement of a third party becomes even less and less necessary so we become fully agents of peace within whatever context we're in. So I'm going to just kind of outline four propositions for an Abrahamic model of peacemaking, and we can engage in a conversation about whether you agree, disagree, have problems with it. And like any good professor, I hope to pose more questions than answer them, so which is very frustrating to my students, but I tell them if I give you all the answers, then you haven't done any work. So the idea is for us to engage in a dialogue and a conversation. So one of the things that I think is important is very often when we look at in the Muslim tradition, Prophet Abraham, and upon him be peace, this idea of him as an individual is often obscured. We forget to look at his own, what we would call sort of spiritual formation and path. And so there are sort of four or five layers that an Abrahamic model can inform for peacemaking. One of them is to think through how, as a prophetic voice, was Abraham able to wrestle with the great questions in life? And how is that a model for individuals who emanate and descend both theologically as well as some of us consider ourselves biological inheritors of the Abrahamic tradition? So one of the things that's really beautiful, and I think about this when I'm teaching my children, is that Prophet Abraham's own example is that as a young child and as a young man, he illustrated the importance of contemplation and engagement with the divine and others on issues of human importance upon which there is not always agreement. So for instance, we have a story in our tradition where he would look at the sun and he would look at the moon and try to discern who and what is holy. So he exhibited for what Muslims, are taught to do in the Quran, this idea of contemplation, this idea of looking at the natural phenomenology of creation. The Quran is full of stories of contemplate the story of an ant, contemplate the story of a bee, contemplate how even the shadows of the created trees and shrubs bend in towards their creator. So he exhibited this capacity to look at nature and to contemplate, so what are the sources of creation? And to wrestle with these major questions. These were not questions without there are doubt. Faith, his faith was based, as many of our Jewish scholars tell us and talk about, this idea of wrestling with these questions that we intellectually and spiritually engage, that we think through these questions. And that's at the very basic level for peacemaking, is being able to understand that our internal peace is not based on just a blind acceptance of all form of belief, or a blind acceptance that our internal conflict is not a lifelong journey. So Prophet Ibrahim's example exhibits that the very beginning of peacemaking is our capacity to be reflective human beings, to deal with the internal questions that are problematic, the internal questions of where do we originate from, the internal impossible questions that continue for our lifetime. And that's the basis of much of his own development. So how do we think about developing a theology of religious engagement through illustrations of wrestling with the great questions of life and purpose? So there are many great scholars that talk about knowledge and the importance of knowledge. And Imam al-Ghazali, in one of his writings, talks about this notion that true learning is that which changes behavior. So the first stage is reflection. The second stage is, how then does that reflection influence our behavior? How do, when we recognize that we are inevitably somehow related to one another in the form that we are all created beings, how does that influence our behavior with one another? So the first step of being formed as peacemakers is to reflect upon and think through questions of great importance. And I think, for me, that is one of the great illustrations of that Abrahamic tradition, is here is a prophet who is seeing truths, but not because he was led to them without any struggle, not because he didn't think through these questions, not because he didn't deal with the challenges. We know both Jews and Muslims share the story of his relationship with his father and the relationship of watching what it meant to worship those that were beyond the monotheistic God that Abraham came to exemplify in his work. So he discussed, he engaged. So he engaged internally, he engaged deeply. One other thing that is really common to the different Abrahamic traditions, the prophets that we share and those that we do not all of us agree on the status of Jesus, upon him be peace, as a divine. As you know, Muslims see him as an important and great prophet, however not the Son of God. And Jews, as we know, don't accept him in the way that Christians and Muslims deal with him. But one thing that's really remarkable about many of these prophets is that they practice what one might call a radical solitude. All of them took major time and pains to be within the womb of nature and reflect upon the importance of this aspect of spiritual formation for peacekeeping. For those of you that are Muslim, if you make Hajj, you see, or you're able to see, where Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where he would retreat to get a perspective on human relationships. And it's a mountain and a cave that's very hard to reach. And that's where the first revelation carried and the first revelation came to him, Iqra, to read. So I think one of the things, as we think about for peacemaking, is the prophetic voices that come through our traditions practice not just a form of sharing their belief with others, but they spent a lot of time on formation of themselves. And more as we're doing peacemaking, I think I had just finished an article for an edited volume on the spiritual formation of peacemakers. I think as we train peacemakers in our academic settings, beginning to pay attention to their spiritual formation. Because you can give as much information around peace building, you can talk about the phenomenology of peace, the ontological aspects of peacemaking, but ultimately the landscape of where peace or war comes from is the landscape of the human heart. And if the human heart is not receiving its spiritual attention that's necessary, it's just as susceptible to hate as it is to love. So for each of our Abrahamic traditions, to get a sense of how within our own traditions are we forming our young children towards peace? how are we engaging and training and creating curricula within our own communities around peace building? And then at another layer, how are we utilizing the pulpit, the aspect of congregational piety, to tie this inner pietism to a communal spiritual formation for peace? I think thinking through these questions is important to do together, but one of my major concerns when we're in interfaith settings is we do what I call out-nicing each other. We say, no, no, you're great. No, you're really great. No, you're really great. And then when we go back to our communities, do we carry that sort of notion that we are in this game together on earth? And how do we utilize our own ability in our own communities to be ambassadors for peace? When we go back, are we using the same language that we use in front of each other? Or are we breeding and teaching hate? And then when we're one of us, when we're together, we do this process of sharing love. I think, to me, the most powerful aspect of peacemaking is thinking through how our own traditions promote establishing of peace with the other. So that was at the very internal level, thinking through this Abrahamic spiritual formation and the venues for education around spiritual formation in our own communities needs just as much attention as when we get together in such beautiful settings as this. So the other part that I wanted to, sort of the second proposition for an Abrahamic notion of peacemaking is this notion of a monotheistic concept of God as actually a potentially unifying in its implications for the human imperative of charitable engagement and intergroup conversation. So very often the conception of God or the divine, there are now scholars that are saying the notion of the divine as a singular is an impediment to the ability to accept a pluralistic notion of humankind. And in fact, I would say that the way that we interpret the concept of the divine is important, but also we bring to that lens what we want to see. So what can happen if, for instance, the divine as a monotheistic iteration is actually a unifying component of humanity, gives us the ability, for instance, from my community's perspective, to see that within that vastness, within that oneness, is also the 99 attributes of some that are, for human beings, irreconcilable. They're within the divine aspects that we cannot embody as human beings because they're polar opposites. And so the way that we begin to have a conversation and describe the divine can either open doors or close doors to our concept of humanity. So I think to assume or make assumptions that the number, whether it be plural or singular, is the only gateway to an acceptance of a pluralism or a singularity of the experiencing of other human beings, I think is highly problematic. So I think more and more beginning to think less about the iteration of only a numeric quality, but about the depth of how we conceive of the divine and the relationship that it has to a human existence is very important. So for instance, there are times in history that our traditions have engaged in competitive theology, where we say who and which son was sacrificed of Abraham, who was he asked to sacrifice. So we have discourses that are competitive, and we seek to one-up each other, and this continues into our venues and conversations to today, so that the rhetoric and the form of engagement is a competitive approach. Then we have periods of time where we do comparative theology, where the assumption is that someone from one location can move between traditions and articulate within depth an ability to relate to that community setting. So I would have us think about a third layer. So we have competitive, comparative. What about cooperative? What about this idea of coming together and having access to what Catherine Albanese talks about as lived religion? So religion is in our text, but religion is also in the ritual and the ways that we organize ourselves. So what happened if we began to have scholars that came together dialogically, and if the goal was less to interpret the other's tradition and compare, as in comparative stances, or competitive, where we're, our rhetoric is dialectic to the point where we're seeking to outdo the other tradition? What if we move to a point where we engage deeply within our own communal heritages and traditions for peacemaking and articulated with one another what a joint vision of peace building might look like? So I think more and more this is part of the task of humanity at this point, is less to prove one another wrong or right, but to think about what are the values that we bring from our individual traditions to establish peace. So it means that those values and those visions will be different. They should be. That's part of the mark of different traditions. What a Muslim articulation of peace building will look like will be different than a potential Christian articulation, than a Jewish articulation in the Abrahamic sense. I think, though, however, more and more as we think about our hermeneutics and our engagement both with our texts and our communities, thinking about that the project of engaging in war is so detrimental. The instrumentality of war these days is essentially one that will wipe out whole nations. It's no longer a question of my community will survive and yours won't. My village will survive and yours won't. The weapons of war make it such that the questions of war are inherently needing of a response that is as broad as it can be to respond to the level of impact that that war can have in this time. So more and more getting a sense of the interdependence that we have upon one another, because if destruction is inevitable upon all of us, then it behooves us to think about what and how can we co-create models of coexistence. So the third point I wanted to bring to this conversation was that each of our traditions, Abrahamically, has a very robust engagement internally around diversity. So we have, for instance, within the Muslim tradition, ethics of disagreement, clearly articulated ways of being able to generatively disagree with one another. We have, amongst our scholars, developed methodologies, both theologically for disagreement, but those are also find their way into the affect, into the way we articulate those disagreements. It's not merely that they are written disagreements, but how do we approach one another around disagreement? How do we have an ethical obligation when we are disagreeing to actually hold up to a greater degree the ability to disagree without attacking one another through anger? So this is not just a question of disagreement in the scholarly space. It's a question of being able to disagree with one another in a communal, shared religious space, in a family space. Within the Muslim tradition, there is really a hyperbolic emphasis on the importance. So for instance, if someone is a judge, not to make a decision out of anger. If you are in a physical position where you're about to lash out at someone, to make sure that you remove yourself from the potential of anger taking over what we call the ability of the human to rationalize. I often, when I do training, I train in mosques around the country, I call it reintroducing the aql back into the conflict, reintroducing the rational capacity of a human being, which is what separates human beings from the status of animals within our tradition, this ability to reason, the ability to make choice. So how can we think about the gifts of our own scholarly traditions that have for centuries effectively at times and other times ineffectively, let's be honest, not always effectively handled disagreement. But where and how were there nodes of time and context in which we were able to have a faithful pluralism that is rich with each tradition and an ethics of disagreement that is emblematic of theological ties to each source tradition as well as most, to me, what's most important, the sense of humility. So for instance, in an ethics of disagreement from a Muslim perspective, it's not just the scholarship that is important, it's the goal of the scholar. So one of my teachers, he would talk about once the ego becomes the controlling factor in your discourse with another, and that becomes the goal of your disagreement, that disagreement is no longer a valid disagreement because you are merely seeking to trump someone else. And we have actually, in the ethics of disagreement, we have gradations of disagreement. Once it becomes only for personal benefit and no longer for the seeking of mutual truth, then that becomes problematic. And so if we think about within our own communities and our own traditions, so we think about within communities that use consensus, within communities that use methods for agreement and disagreement, how can we articulate and utilize those within our own communities, but also learn from one another as we come together? I think ultimately it becomes a question of humility and a question of the relating to our earlier point about the spiritual formation of a peacemaker. So I think more and more when I train my students to be peacemakers in all forms of conflict internationally and locally, I used to think it was about technique. I used to think it was about being able to be an active listener. I used to think it was about certain skills. But I pay far more attention to how they are exhibiting humility in their capacity to relate to the parties in a conflict. Because a good mediator or a good peacemaker, if their ego is what is driving the resolution, then the parties will ultimately be coerced in some way. And I always tell them, if at the end of the mediation the parties say, we did a really good job, then you've actually done a much better job than if they say, wow, you were a really good mediator, you did a good job. Do you see the difference there? If they take ownership over the process, then that's truly the capacity for that mediator to have exhibited a sense of ego diminishing, which ultimately is one of the most powerful aspects of a religious orientation. By accountability to a higher power, the ability for the ego to be diminished in importance is really a tool, a spiritual tool, a spiritual resource for us to be peacemakers. So the third concept that I wanted to talk about, is this idea of hospitality. And that hospitality is a cultural norm for all three of these traditions. And I think it's a very powerful aspect of our traditions. So if you read many of the biblical stories, the punishments are not necessarily just on the issue at hand, but it's a focus on the hospitality that should have been shown to the stranger, the hospitality that should have been shown to a Samaritan, the hospitality that should have been shown to someone who is of an unknown background, of an unknown tribe, of an unknown community. So this idea of hospitality shows that religion is not just one that is textual, but it is an experiential manifestation of a web of relationships. So how, as a Muslim community, how as a Christian community, how as a Jewish community, can the idea of hospitality, not just as a religious norm, but as a cultural norm, become part of how we socialize our children, socialize our communities, to be able to be open to accepting the presence of the other? Keep in mind here, I'm not talking about a unifying acceptance of one another's theological orientation. And I think this is one of the problems in a lot of our interfaith engagement, is the assumption that we need to move towards a space where there's one universal truth that's accepted by all. I think more and more about a theology of engagement. What is the Christian perspective of engagement with non-Christians? Less about what is the Christian belief about accepting in the afterlife who goes or who doesn't. What is the Muslim belief of who gets in and who doesn't? I tell my students that some of the most powerful work is done by two people who may believe the other is going to hell, but they can actually sit down and engage with one another even though they may have this ultimate truth claim that may be exclusive of one another. So what I want to point out is that it's the theology of how we engage with one another that needs more and more articulation, because I think we've spent a lot of energy on the assumption that a theology that is accepting of a one universal belief translates always into behavior that is tolerant. And I don't think that that is a connection that is always the case. I think giving more and more attention to what does it mean to engage respectfully when we disagree? What does it mean to have a hospitable church, a hospitable mosque, a hospitable synagogue to people of other traditions? So I think operationalizing within the Muslim tradition, the Quran tells us that part of Prophet Muhammad, upon him be peace, his mission was mercy, rahma, and it's not just to Muslims, but to all of humankind. So in my work, I think more and more of how do we operationalize mercy to one another as individuals, also institutionally. So I wanted to point out, I think a lot of times the energy that we spend either in our dialogic encounters as well as in our theological inquiry is thinking about what do our traditions say around process? What do our traditions say or help guide us through in engagement with the other? So I was, I'll give you a story. I was at an interfaith conversation, and my dean turned to me. He's Quaker, and he turned to me and he said, "So Najiba," he wrote about it in the Huffington Post. It was the opposite. So we were in an interfaith conversation with a Jewish professor, me and my dean, and our students. And I said, "Well, let me explain to you why I do interreligious dialogue, because the Quran tells me that part of my reason for being on this earth is to know ta'arufu, to know the other, because God created us in different tribes and different backgrounds, and so the reason that I engage in interreligious conversation is to know one another. I have a very clear purpose." And then my Jewish colleague articulated a purpose. And then I asked my dean, "So why are you, he asked our Christian students, "So what is your purpose?" And they said, "We don't really know. We are not really sure what our theology of interreligious engagement is." So I point out in that circle, that happened to be, the configuration could have been completely different. It could have been a Christian professor articulating their theology of engagement. So it wasn't necessarily a theology of religious acceptance of the other in terms of ultimate truth claims, but it was how do you deal with difference? And so, it could have been the same questions could have been put in that circle. It happened to be that our students hadn't thought of it. It could have been Muslim students not remembering. So the point wasn't that one group had thought about it or not. It's that we just think about it, that we're able to think about why are we engaging? So I tell people it's good to be suspicious of interreligious engagement, because we need a theological transparency for why we are doing this work. So, for instance, is the orientation around peacemaking. Is that why we're engaging in this work? But I think to assume that it is always a universally accepted norm and that it should be done just because it should be done is not good enough. We need to thicken that inquiry, thicken the reasoning behind why we are engaging with the other, because just as much as there are people willing to engage, there are many who are unwilling to engage. So I work a lot on Muslim evangelical Christian relations. And many who are asked to come to the table will say, "Well, I assume that if I come into this door that I have to accept both in the Muslim and the evangelical perspective, that I have to leave my religious beliefs at the door and accept what the other person is saying." And when I work with communities, I talk about the fact that that's not the process, that bring who you are fully into this space, but let us pre-negotiate a process by which you are allowed to keep your authentic belief, but to learn and engage with the other. So I think to understand that there is a legitimate hesitation to Abrahamic engagement in peacemaking is very important, because there are people who are left out of the equation when we are not able to be understanding or have a clear transparency of why any one community is engaging in this process. So that was what I wanted to get to, was this idea of thinking more and more about the culture of religion, and more and less of only to say, well, we believe in this, but what does that actually mean in engagement? And I've found that sometimes we can spend a lot of time in our interreligious settings articulating beliefs, but not actually changing the way we relate to one another in terms of our human interaction and our ability to respect one another. My concern with interreligious engagement is it promotes what I call episodic empathy, that when you and I are together in this setting, there is an empathy that is created. But once I leave, I may go back even further in my ability to relate to one another. So as we know, in conflict resolution, human contact theory says that the contact that we have with one another moves us into what we call deprovincialization, a less and less of a perspective in which the other is seen as threatening. But I think part of what we need to think about is not just the quantity of interaction, but the quality of interaction. And the quality of interaction doesn't come from us always agreeing on everything. That's not how we need to evaluate interreligious engagement. To me, the quality of interaction is how do we navigate the serious questions that divide us, the serious issues that separate us. I've worked with a lot of interreligious groups, and what they'll say is, well, if there's something that's really a hot button issue, we just don't talk about it. And I think, okay, so there's empathy there, but it's a very surface empathy. So clearly we need to stage our engagement so in the beginning we don't walk in and deal with the most difficult questions. Any of you who know mediation and conflict resolution theory, we start with the parts that are common, but if we only stay there, I think we do a disservice. And so sometimes when I go into communities and talk about dialogue or interreligious activity, it's already maligned because their perspective is, well, you just want me to go in and do this, this, and this. And so we have to be very careful about how we construct engagement and allow spaces for healthy, generative dissent. How does dissent actually build us into deeper empathy with one another? So I have a lot of conflict resolution systems design approaches for that, but I won't go into that today, but I wanted us to think through that. Because in interreligious conversations, what can happen is the capacity to move to the lowest common denominator is a thrust in those dialogic spaces. So we have to work against that interest that pushes us to always look for only unity. So I often talk about it as there's a capacity to move to lessen the demonizing of one another, but to be able to harmonize while we have different tunes. We don't have to have the same tune, but we can come to a point where we learn to decrease the demonization and move towards some level of interreligious harmony and coexistence. So last of all, I wanted to just propose one point, which was that all of our traditions focus on moral imperatives to heal the world and to pursue justice, and this can be a theological springboard for joint social justice projects. So I think one of the pieces that I find is often missing in the work that I do is being able to train those that do interreligious engagements to be ambassadors in their own communities. So how, as we come to one another, are we seeing the same people come to every interreligious encounter that we're designing, either in an academic or communal setting? How are we training individuals to go back and engage deeply in their own communities to become ambassadors for interreligious conflict resolution or peacemaking? And one of the frames that's very helpful is to think about justice. And justice is one of the most highly prized aspects of these different traditions. But how do we create a justice that's mutually inclusive in its goal of establishing equality, not just for one community, but for all of humanity? I think that is one of the basic questions, because justice can be often a dividing line. It is not always a line that can bring one to acceptance of the need for justice for the other. So to me, speaking up in interfaith advocacy is a holy obligation. when injustice is done against not just those within our community, but from those who are outside of our community. And this is a very specific set of skills to train someone to speak up on behalf of when another community is attacked, but they do so with the legitimacy and authenticity and support of their own community as they are speaking out for someone from another community. Do you see the layers of negotiation that are happening in that process? Because ultimately, it's easy for us to speak out when there are no risks that are taken. But when we speak out and there is a risk that is taken, that is a very powerful space to be in. But it also takes us, it takes within the Abrahamic framework to think through how can we seek to bring along our own community to stand up for someone who is an outsider. And that's a very, I think, a piece of our theological inquiry as well. Looking at examples, for instance, when Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam stood up for someone who was not a Muslim, when someone from his own community, and there are many examples of this, when there was a violation against someone who was not a Muslim, to speak up and say, even though this person or this person is not a Muslim, but they in fact need the protection that is important within a Muslim community, sort of a form of radical hospitality. There are examples throughout all of our traditions. What happened, if many of you know, the story of the Albanian Muslims who stood up in times during the Holocaust, or when there are now in our time these days, there are people from each of our communities, Christians who give sanctuary to Muslims in conflicts around the world, Jewish community members that stand up for a Christian. I mean, there are examples of people who take those risks, but those are the stories that are not told enough. Those are the stories that are seen as exceptional, as points or parts of history that are kind of aberrations of history. What if we began to see those nodes of relationship as the potential for our communities to build the ability to trust one another, to speak up when justice is maligned? And so there are really, I was really surprised as a Muslim, I studied after law school. I just went to study at The Hague in the Netherlands. And so there were students from all over the world. And I came to this group of students, and the students from Rwanda came to me and they said, "We love your people." And so you can imagine this is quite a while back, after some major issues that Muslims were not perceived as very positive. And so I thought, oh my goodness, what's going on here? Why are the Rwandans so excited to see me? And what they told me was that in that conflict, Muslims actually played a role in their in a peacemaking role between the communities in that conflict. And so it was a story that I wasn't familiar with. It was a story that I didn't know. And it was very important for me, not because it bolstered my belief in me, in my own community, in my own tradition, but it allowed me to understand that some of the worst stereotypes in the world are the ones that we accept as true about ourselves. If we accept the inevitability of any one tradition as having peace inoperable in any way, then that is a very dangerous place to be, because it made me realize how much of the narratives of my the outside perceptions and stereotypes of Muslims have I accepted as true about myself. Thinking through, what is your perception of your own tradition? What is the perception of a Christian or a Jewish or a Muslim tradition? How is it portrayed in the popular media? How is it viewed? How is it shared? And how much have you come to accept as inevitable? Not just about each other's traditions. That is a very dangerous thing as well. But I think actually the more insidious form of these tropes that exist are the ones that we began to see as inevitable about our own traditions. So what happens is, even if we go back to our own texts and our own traditions seeking peace, we are doing it in the shadow of the assumption that they are promoting a potential for harm. So we're unable to unearth the legitimate, authentic resources for peace in our own tradition if our starting point is that we're rebutting one of a narrative that only promotes a negative or warlike mentality. So I wanted to point that out. It's a very sort of, not a very obvious point, but one in which I have, when I do training, and I think one thing that's very important is that more and more those of us that are peacemakers need to think about the circles in our own communities that we can influence. So just as much as I do interfaith work, I spend as much time in my own community, in my own mosque. So I'm going to Paris, I mentioned, but I was the last 2 weekends in my own mosque where my children are in Sunday school, teaching the 10 conflict resolution skills of Prophet Muhammad, and then talking about Prophet Muhammad as a transformational leader. Because I think what can happen is we can become outwardly focused and that inward work becomes missed. And what was so surprising to me were these ordinary Muslim American citizens saying, we're hungry for this. Because if you go Google Islam and peace, every article is written from the perspective of the assumption of a need for de-radicalization. But here are ordinary individuals that want to engage in their texts, that are hungry for resources that can provide an authentic perspective on peace building that's legitimate, that's culturally competent in their own community. So I think as we do our work as peacemakers, the outwardly focused perspective is important, but that inwardly work, and sometimes the most difficult work is within our own communities. Sometimes the most difficult type of engagement is within spaces where we have relationships that are of great stake, where our personal reputations are on the line. So I think just to encourage all of us to think, if we're thinking about world peace, it's helpful to think about what you can do for a conflict out there. But what's even more powerful is what can you do in your spheres of influence to promote an authentic, legitimate, holistic peace. So just to think through again, just the 4 points I wanted to talk about to summarize, sort of thinking of them as stages that of influence, is the Abrahamic discourse, the dynamic discourse with God and with others around great questions, so that we're able to think through how can the human mind and heart be ready to deal with difference? How do we prime cognitively, spiritually, intellectually to deal with difference? And that comes through the forms of spiritual practices that we talked about, and teachings and contemplation. And then this notion of the concept of the divine and its relationship to help build bonds between humanity as we articulate how the theologies that we are able to share with one another, holding on to our own concept of the divine, but what do we learn about our relationship and our concept of the divine? How does it inform the definition of our relationship both individually with the divine as well as our horizontal relationship with one another? Then thinking about this idea of a hospitality that can become and is a cultural norm within all of our communities. How do we strengthen that? How do we capture it? Sometimes we don't even know we're doing it, and sometimes it's cultural. So the casserole after church, my husband is from Northern Indiana, the casserole that's given after church, the chai in Kashmir that you can't leave home without. We also have great cultural resources around hospitality. Whenever people visit me, my mother will call me on the phone and says, what did you feed them? That's her first question. Did you feed them something? And if we had neighbors come even to the door, my parents would actually invite in, you know, Mormon missionaries. Whoever was at the door, they would come in and they would feed them, because no matter what purpose they had to be shown hospitality. So that's a cultural norm for all of our communities. How do we capture that, think of it, value it, raise it up even higher when we're engaging with the other? So thinking of religion is also a cultural articulation. And last of all, how can we begin to think of not just interfaith dialogue, but interfaith advocacy in stepping up to the plate when communities of the other are being attacked and harmed? And how do we bring our own communities into a space where that is something that they're willing to take a risk for? So that's a prophetic vision for Abrahamic peacemaking. It may or may not resonate with what you already know, or I'm just hoping to pose more questions, and so I wanted to open up the door for a conversation at this point. Yes, that means I'm done. some water.
Thank you very much, Najiba, for stimulating a lot of questions and a lot of thought, I think. You've given us a lot to think about.
Thank you. Your presentation and the way you are expressing the religion makes perfect sense to me in a philosophical and ethical and on individual level. While we are not anymore individuals, we are struggling with the state structures, we are struggling in different roles as politicians, military generals, and we have certain obligations to maintain national interest if we are representing, or national threat and risk. So to me, it sounds a little bit difficult to have religion play a more significant role on a more structural level. And I think not only Islam and most of the religions have been couldn't really play a better role post on post-Westphalian situation when we have the concept of nation states. So how do you see the relationship of religion would play a more constructive role in terms of bringing, you know, major political problems and conflicts on a global and state level?
You know, I think you make an excellent point that we can speak about this in a utopian kind of perspective. So today I was articulating clearly Abrahamic kind of perspective, how it plays out vis-a-vis state actors. I would argue that it's actually within this century that the role of religion in being able to solve problems that are transnational in nature, that religion is essential to that role. Because more and more, for instance, I was talking about issues of gang violence in Los Angeles. That has become now an issue related to El Salvador, where we have gang members that are in Los Angeles going back to El Salvador. And surprisingly, one of the roles of religion in a state that was unable to handle this violence, the Catholic Church and other religious leaders were able to broker a truce in El Salvador. And in the last year, we've seen a 60% decrease in violence. So the structures and the venues of religion can be potentially spaces where alternative dispute resolution can generatively take place. But that takes the spiritual leaders to have some moral legitimacy, because there's moral power as well. There's state power, but there's also moral power. So for instance, in the United States, we could not have had the civil rights movement, which was an interfaith movement. We could not have had the changes in our laws without the pressure of religious leaders who joined across religious backgrounds. If you look at the studies on the anti-apartheid movement, there is an inevitable relationship between a state structure changing when people have the moral imperative to take the risk. Sometimes, as we know, around nonviolent organizing, the risk can be a physical risk. But it becomes most powerful when it's not just one community of one religious persuasion. The greatest social movements and the greatest movements that have gone on to establish human rights are the ones that can harness the power of bringing together people across religious lines for a common purpose of justice. So I think your point is well taken. I think as we look at different movements, to not dismiss religion as irrelevant, because what has happened, and there's a new area many of you know about, it's not that new, but this idea of faith-based diplomacy. I just finished an article on the use of restorative justice in blasphemy cases. And what can happen is if religion is not at the negotiation table, then it finds its power in other dystopian forms that are very problematic. So I think your question is one that needs to be addressed contextually within each conflict and really explored. And that's where I think the role of theologians is really important, because I think we think often religion is articulated ultimately by those that have the power to educate. And in most places where religion has been used for violence, there's a vast amount of lack of education around religion. And so thinking more and more about how do we, for instance, have a peacemaking curriculum that's used in madrasa systems. That has been a really powerful tool, but it needs to be indigenized to that community. It needs to be within the culturally competent language and the examples. So for instance, there was a group, I'll just answer this question quickly, a group that was going to a part of to Kashmir, where I was born. And they said, oh, we don't need anyone on our team that's Kashmiri. We don't need cultural competency. So I found out later, because Kashmir is a small place, I have cousins and uncles, and they said, oh, we went to the training and they did maritime disputes. So maritime disputes are disputes around ocean conflicts. If any of you know where Kashmir is, it's a landlocked valley in the Himalayas. But your point is really important, that religion and I think the study and the definition of religion needs to also be part of this conversation. So I mentioned one theorist, Catherine Albanese, talking about lived religion. There are many, many more deep explorations of the definition of the word religion that are now being contested and discussed. And I think that could really enhance the world of conflict resolution by looking at religious resources. Too often I get frustrated because we get together and just talk about verses from the Bible, verses from the Quran. How does that translate into behavior? How is that what does that mean in that community? What are the tribal affiliations? What are the customary laws? All of that needs to be part of the conversation. Or else people will look at culture and leave out religion. I think this intertwining is inevitable. Human identity is never just one piece or the other. I want to say one last thing to that. One of the biggest issues in interreligious dialogue is when we get together and elevate religion as the organizing principle of an institution, we run the danger of de-racializing or de-racializing is a word I would use. So for instance, when we're doing a mediation or conflict resolution process with the American Muslim community and the Christian community and the Jewish community, we have to ask, what is the racial composition of people at the table? If it's an African-American Muslim, there's a particular history there. If it is a Yemeni Jew, that's a different history than someone who is a European Jew. If it's a African-American Christian, if it's a Latino Christian. So my worry in this new form of interreligious education is to not utilize interreligious engagement to de-racialize or take away the cultural context that people come from. Because I've seen that in institutions and groupings where they say, we brought together Muslims, Christians, and Jews. And I'll say, what Muslims? What Christians? What Jews? Because your process may fall apart also internationally if that's the only organizing principle that you're bringing to the table. Because religion is very important, but for some communities, they don't separate their religion from their ethnic identity. And so I'm just pointing that out. I think it's an excellent question. I should allow for others, but I could keep going on. But that's one point I wanted to make about the danger of only utilizing religion as your principle for the taxonomy of organizing dialogue. It's okay, Californians are nice. We want to know how you feel, you know. My husband's from Northern Indiana, and after he sees his mother after 6 months, they just stand next to each other and say, hello. And they look at each other and say, hello. And in my culture, I look at that and I think, that's affection, right? So we have different cultural ways of communicating. Californians want to know how everyone in the room is feeling, what's going on, what's your energy, what's your vibe.
You can keep talking as far as I'm concerned. Really enjoyed it. I guess the question I have is, the perspective that you bring, it seems to me, is anathema to the religious right of all the traditions. Mm. It's a liberal perspective. It's one of tolerance, acceptance, understanding, whereas on the religious right, I guess from any tradition, that's not the way to go. How do you deal with that?
I would argue that the word liberal is very contextual, again, because I don't consider myself like on the outskirts of practicing Islam. I'm not someone who, to locate myself, would say that my religion is not important to me or that I'm post-textual. I feel very tethered to my text still. So, but I think you raise a really good point that how should we put it, that what can happen and what's dangerous is this could be a conversation of like-minded people of every tradition getting together and having the same conversation. And that's why I think it's really important to think about a plurality of pluralisms. So the pluralism that brings you to the table might be kind of a Diane Eckian perspective. No, I'm saying just anyone, not you. For someone else, I learned this in a long process of Muslim evangelical dialogue, was that that sometimes the theology that's articulated for engagement may not be the same as a progressive viewpoint. And are we able, I think what's interesting in this form of religious pluralism is it could be very exclusive. It could set up the conversation and shut out people who have dissenting viewpoints. So I think as we construct conversations, to think about the language that's being used that will include people, and to know that there are ways and times where you might have to do things slowly. So for instance, in some communities, we've had to meet first, we can't meet openly. We have to bring people together quietly, because to be seen together is a huge threat. And so that has been one of the methodologies of convening. And ultimately, I think in any group, even in the quote-unquote conservative of whatever tradition you're talking about, there, not everyone's a conservative in exactly the same way. So there are people who, within that rubric, I came to understand that I was also demonizing people who were often on the Christian right. I assumed that they all had the same perspective. I assumed that they might not be willing to engage in interreligious dialogue. And so I'll give you one really interesting example. This idea of interfaith dialogue was very problematic for some of the evangelical communities that we were engaging with, because the assumption of interfaith is that it is moving towards a syncretic tradition. So there was a lot more comfortability with the word multi-faith. So literally, people would come or not come based on the description of the process. So it was fascinating. That's a very basic articulation. But I would say that each tradition benefits from an internal diversity, and that we, just as much as one could argue that it's important to have one particular orientation, that is detrimental to that religious tradition as well. That internal diversity is important. So the question comes to me is, what would motivate people to come to the table? What is keeping them away? And is there a way to design the table that would be authentically engaging of them? But inevitably, any process is going to exclude someone. And I think your point gets to that. That's really true, that not everyone is going to be comfortable with every process. So I think being cognizant and transparent of that is really important. So to make the assumption, if you're doing a Christian-Muslim dialogue, that is inclusive of all people from those perspectives is problematic. But I think that there are legitimate leaders that can be sought out within those communities that would be willing to slowly and gradually engage in a safe way, in a way that's safe to them to have a conversation. So does that answer your question?
Most of the interfaith dialogues that I have been part of and studied or watched on TV, there has been, most of them has been at the macro or meso level. Mm-hmm. At the macro level, an imam and a priest, or two big institutions coming, Catholic Church or yeah. Islam, or coming together and talking about big issues. And they also come in with a perceived conceived notion of who is superior religion. Yeah. So nothing gets done. And I honestly think there hasn't been one effective large, at the large level, interfaith dialogues that has been really effective in understanding each other. And at the meso level and institution levels, we have had these interfaith dialogues, but it has to be kind of around this academic context. Yeah. But what the most important level to me, the micro level, where attitudes and behaviors are needs to be addressed, doesn't change. For example, I'm Muslim, and at times I haven't brought up the issue because of the social tension that it causes, especially among my own age teenagers. I will not talk about the religion because the discomfort that creates, and you know, whether it's a difference, whether they have a different version of Islam. I've been hesitant at times to not bring up the religion. So I feel like I would like your input on that, and that the micro level, the attitudes and behaviors are not addressed, and we talk about being religiously, you know, acceptance of other religions, but with our behaviors and how we teach our children is we still like, nope, Islam is it and Christianity is it, you know, the concept of absolute. We teach them, but I don't understand where the level of acceptance comes then and our behaviors and attitudes.
I think you raised the point. That's why I think, and my mentors, Glenn Stassen and Sue Thistlethwaite, talk about just peacemaking practices. So instead of thinking just about the concept of peace as an abstraction, how is it performed? And you have at this university great practitioners and researchers in restorative justice. And so my question, I think, part of thinking through is this notion of how do we build encounters that are behavioral changing encounters, where it's not merely that we get together and we discuss, but how can those encounters be places for safe practice and experimentation of what it would it mean to actually behave with one another in a way that was demonstrative of a more understanding perspective. Because in fact, the kinds of dialogues that you articulate, those public dialogues, they show how you can engage with the other in a way that's more damaging. You know, it's an example of here, this is the way that you can engage in a way that will cut the other down. And this is how you can model that behavior. And it's especially more and more we are thinking about the relationship between affect, which is our human emotional manifestation, and ethics. So I think you get to that point in which scholars of ethics are more and more looking at this notion that ethics is not just a system of belief or a political articulation, it's also how it's manifested in the human relationship. So many, I'm sure, of you have read Levinas, who is a Jewish philosopher, and he talks about the face-to-face encounter and what we learn from that face-to-face encounter and the affectivity and the importance. It's not just that we're getting together and building relationships, but how are we transformed by those relationships? It's not just that, as you said, I'm knowing either someone who's Muslim or I'm getting to know someone who's Christian, and out of that, that's great. But what does it do to us as individuals and rearrange the way we see the world and recalibrate our behavior? Because I think that's really important. And also, for instance, I was in a particular interfaith dialogue, and I could see the repugnance when I walked into the room. There was an affect that I could feel, that I came in as a Muslim woman, and there with some of the people in the room, some of whom may have even been from my tradition, there is this part of our human consciousness that is almost, it's beyond our ability to control, but it's actually sometimes the truest manifestation of who we are, right? And that is part of what I'm hoping. Moskowitz talks about this idea of perspective taking, that what we need to do to mature intellectually is to see the world from someone else's perspective. And in fact, Moskowitz and other scholars, Carol Winner, have said that it's important to be able to do perspective taking to be academically successful, but also to be a fully conscious and engaged human being. So for instance, if any of you deal with issues, young children who have autism or along the autism scale, one of the difficulties is an incapacity to see the world from someone else's perspective. It's a developmental issue that we have to work with children on to see the world from someone else's perspective. So I think you get to the point of how do we have engagements that allow us to begin to appreciate the world from someone else's perspective. And when it comes to religion, this is by far the hardest thing to do. I was speaking with Ed earlier. Muhammad Abu Nimer talks about, so we can negotiate culture. We can negotiate many other aspects of our human existence, but religio-relativity, a relativity that is possible around religion to say, for a minute let go of being a Muslim and see what the world might look like from a different perspective, that's really difficult and maybe impossible. I'm not even sure it's possible. I think that's the question that you raise. So how do we explore? And I would say that I would say that dialogues, that there are kind of a few key characteristics in the work that I've done. I've also done a lot of interracial dialogues in situations where people are literally killing each other, so in violence. So I would say, as many of us know, that first of all, such engagements have to be sustained. They cannot be just one time. Such engagements have to reach beyond the elite of that social organization or structure, but they have to have the blessing of the elite. That's very important. You can have lay people get together, but if they do not have the larger social structure supporting it, then it won't be sustainable. The other piece is, I think, speaking from personal narrative is very important. I think your question gets to that. There has to be safety and trust that's built so that people will begin to speak from their personal narrative. Because a lot of us carry trauma that's imposed even from our own religious experience. If you talk to, not everyone has the best experience with their own tradition, right? So what we bring into our experience of the religious other can also be tainted by the very baggage we carry from our experience of religion in general. And I think you point to that sometimes what if we're afraid to talk about something in our own community? That's not going to be the best setting for one to be able to go out and then experience with the other. It's even a more, could be a potentially unsafe situation. So I think that's also very important as well, is to think through what are the varied degrees of trauma that people are bringing that come to the table, and how do we create scenarios that have conversations that address that. I think also I spend a lot more time preparing people before they come together to talk about transparency of process, to pre-negotiate what they're going to go into, because I think there are certain assumptions around interreligious dialogue, and I think your question gets to that the assumption is that in some ways it's a project of liberal political activity, that if that's only what interreligious dialogue is, then we're all in trouble. But if that's what it is, then let's say that's what it is. Do you see what I'm saying? There has to be some transparency that's pre-negotiated and agency given to the parties who are coming to the table for them to understand what they're doing. I've gone to so many interreligious encounters that were well-intentioned, but there was no preparation. There was no pre-negotiation of the rules of engagement and the capacity for the individuals who came to the table. And I'll point out one other difficulty that we face, at least in the United States, is we have an asymmetry of religious education. So I was asked on 9/11, on the 10th anniversary, to speak at a very large public gathering. And they're in different scenarios. This is just emblematic. So we'll have a rabbi that's educated at a very prestigious rabbinical school. Then we will have a pastor that went to Yale Divinity School. And then we don't have in America Muslim seminaries. So I have an imam that can't really speak English, who's on the stage with people who have the best education that their religious community has to offer. And that's highly problematic on multiple layers, right? Because it's problematic because if we think of religion as culture, this individual doesn't have the capacity to engage in that conversation. But also publicly, if that's a representation of a Muslim identity, what is that doing for the whole Muslim community in that enterprise that person is engaged in, if there's an asymmetry? So I think understanding that not all communities come to this conversation equally equipped is very important as well. And it doesn't mean that they don't have the capacity for peace building in their own tradition. That individual may have had a vast amount of knowledge, but they didn't have the cultural tools to articulate and contemporize their knowledge to their context. And that, I think, is where it's not just religious education that it's important, but it's the skills building and the capacity to negotiate in the cultural context of whatever that community. And the same can happen if someone from, if you're doing international work, when you go in, you need to know how people negotiate in that context so that the situation could be completely turned around. You may have someone who has a lot of knowledge but doesn't understand the cultural context. So I think culture is always at play and always important. I want to point out one last thing. We haven't talked about gender. Let's be clear, I'm clearly a woman up here, so that's one issue I just want to acknowledge in case you didn't know. I wanted to point out that one of the other problems with only gathering religious elite is that it keeps from the table women. And we know that in many, many communities, peacemaking, Etin Anwar's work and others in places all over the world, that actually the major agents for peacemaking at the interpersonal level, as you mentioned, are actually often women who are able to do very effective peacemaking. So I think interreligious encounters that privilege only the clergy of a tradition are also problematic because they don't engage the wider spectrum for communities in which many of our traditions, women are not yet in a position where they have a full spiritual authority. So I think that's also dangerous. And I often end up as the only woman on a panel, or I'll be the moderator, and it's a rabbi, an imam, and a pastor, and I'm thinking, wow, but I know in that community, I know this Muslim woman who does all the interfaith work. Like, why are they not at the table too? So your question is really a great one that gets to that. I think maybe time for one more, or what do you think? My answers are really long, I apologize. That means they're really good questions, see?
Yes, thank you. I think you have been perhaps more involved in all these interesting practical contexts of interracial, also interreligious, and peacemaking processes. But I'm sure there is a more fundamental or more profound underlying theoretical framework behind this. I'm really interested in hearing from you something about that. For example, you mentioned that in the Quran, the Prophet of Islam is described as the mercy for the whole world. But I'm sure also that you're aware that, for example, perhaps other Muslims would use another verse in the Quran saying that Muhammad is the prophet of God and those with him are harsh against the unbelievers, non-believers, disbelievers, and yet they are very kind among themselves. So how do we go about making a kind of interpretation of Islam which would weight this side more than the other side? And what is the kind of theoretical, hermeneutical underlying assumptions that you would make in order to make this happen?
I think that's a huge question, and that's not a question just for Islam. I think that's a question for any religious tradition, is what are the hermeneutics of peacemaking? I think that's a fundamental question. So in the work that I do, I am really in the area of what we talk about as religious education or practical theology. So I look at the practical implications of teaching and work. But I actually think that's part of the answer, is the theoretical, philosophical interpretation is important, but the operationalizing of those theoretical frameworks is important. So I would say, for instance, just what I do literally in my work to educate is to begin to also look, for instance, at the example of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, from a lens of not just when he spoke about engagement with the other, but looking at the phenomenology of hadith literature. And we also have very different methodologies around hadith depending on location, right, of one's of how one locates oneself within the religious tradition. But for instance, to see are there ways to extrapolate a practical theology for peacemaking that are found in, for instance, this is what some scholars have done with the issue of women, like when there is a woman in the room, just the physical body located in that space was very important. So similarly with peace building, is there a way to think of the Quranic injunctions? What are the, this is your area, clearly. So this is, what are the questions that are generalizable? What are the questions that are specific? What are the greater spirit of law questions? What are the overriding principles that we can begin to think of as civilizing civilizing the world in a way that we can imagine a Muslim culture articulated as a healthy contribution to society. So I think your question is one that is Khalid Abulfadl in his book on tolerance in the place of Islam, whatever you think, I'm not talking about him necessarily as an individual, but as a scholar, he says that there's an under-theorizing of pluralism within the hermeneutics of the Quran, that there are many nodes and spaces and times that the Quran, as well as hadith and the uswar, the example of the prophet, could be utilized for peacemaking, but those have been under-theorized in a religion that has often been in the majority status. So needing to explore and look at pluralism in that way is very important. So I think your point is well taken. There's another piece to it that I think is also important. It's the way that we teach. I think we were joking about it a little bit earlier. The way that Islamic pedagogy is articulated and the way that history is written. So I mentioned in India there's Maulana Wahiduddin Khan and others. And these are individuals, whatever you think about them, just the ideas of, for instance, the way that Islamic history is taught is always by wars. And actually that's the way history is taught of any tradition. So how do we re-engage even with our historical tradition to acknowledge when there were times of war, but also to think about what are the conditions of the theological interpretation in that cultural ethos and zeitgeist that allowed for peace to flourish? So for instance, a lot of people talk about the golden age, conviviality. To me, what's interesting is, well, what was happening in the religious interpretation of not just Muslims, but also those with whom Muslims were engaging? What allowed for a capacity to accommodate one another dynamically? Was it human relationships? Was it an economic reality? I mean, what are the conditions? And I think we have to really think through those aspects, because religion is found, again, in texts, but it's also found in context. So I think thinking through and having a really robust study. So there are reams and reams of books written about religion and war. There are some of the highest investments for scholarship and research are done around the instrumentality to develop war, whatever countries or religions we come from. I think we have just a drop in the bucket for how do we begin to have a deep inquiry within whatever tradition we're from for an articulation of peace. And not peace that is merely ephemeral, but a lasting peace. And a peace that takes into account the contested viewpoints of text. So to me, that's really the question that we need to pose. I can't go now into with you ayah by ayah. We can have that conversation. But I think that hasn't been done. That hasn't been done in a way that is robust. And I was trying to mention this idea of cooperative theology, where we do it individually, but we get together and discuss it across traditions. Because one thing I wanted to point out is we have our own traditions, but in the frame of the Abrahamic, we have resources that Prophet Isa introduces into peacemaking that we can learn from. We have resources that in the stories, when I teach peacemaking now, I talk about the story of Moses. There are stories in there. We have these stories. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is the uswa and the example for Muslims. Prophet Moses and Abraham are important to the Jewish community. Prophet Isa, Jesus, is important to the Christian community. But what's really remarkable about some of the scholars that you read in earlier historical times, Muslim scholars will talk about Prophet Isa, will talk about Prophet Musa, will have an epistemic commitment to the Quran because those stories are in the Quran, right? So more and more, I think it's also having a robust engagement with our own tradition, as well as understanding what are the tools that are present in the narratives. Ultimately, peace building is built upon narratives and storytelling and the capacity to have transformative stories that move us from pain to healing. And to me, our holy texts are a record of that pain and the violence that we find. In fact, isn't always an injunction for violence. I see it as a cautionary tale. look what happens if you go into this. Look what happened to this tribe, that tribe. There's a lesson in that. It could be interpreted as that's what should happen, but it could also be interpreted as what do we learn from that experience. So building and thinking through the narratives that are present in our text, not just for their juristic importance, but for their capacity to help recalibrate human psychology is very important. And that's why I think some of your work with looking at also the poets of many of our communities and traditions. In Kashmir, the way that most people access their religious experience used to be through the poetry, through Persian poetry. That's why both of my grandparents speak Persian, and my parents learned it as well. I think we have so many resources that are present in our traditions, and the reductionist attitude to one or two things, meaning a position, is not possible when the mind is engaged in very many many forms of inquiry. So I think the depth that Islam has to offer for peace building has been done historically, but I think is only scratching its surface in the scholarship that's in English. I would say that's a problem I face. I want to teach a class, and I'm thinking, how can I, you know, I can't really translate this for my students, but I do think that there is a lot of literature that is present in our tradition, and so those are some of the pieces. That's literally how I go about doing this, to explain to you, and I'm happy to share. One last thing I wanted to share with you from the American Muslim tradition, we have the African American Muslim community that has had a practical theology of neighborliness. Imam Warithdin Muhammad did not write, but he taught his community that the way to, for instance, deal with issues of drug infestated communities was to join with everyone in the community and to help get drug dealers out of your neighborhood. And he based it on the Quranic notion of charity to neighbors. And so I'm writing an article right now for Oxford talking about this notion of theology is written, but sometimes it's practice. So what happens when you have a community that has this history of over 50 years of actually showing an interreligious engagement that was to the benefit of everyone in that neighborhood, but it's not, the scholar didn't write it down, but he taught and practiced it. And I think we need to recognize also theologies happen in the manifestation of practices. And that could be another epistemological point that we can look at through our historical inquiry as well. I think that's it for today, but thank you.
Thank you.
My voice is running out.
Thank you so much. We really worked you hard today. You gave us an awful lot. And thank you all for the good questions that led to more stimulating discussion.
Thank you. Thank you.